Well, welcome to part two of study 15 on the crumbling north. I hope you had a nice little break there. This is a long lesson, and so that's why we're breaking it into two of them here. So far in our prior recording, we've gone through the first four pages of the handout today. Those four pages first started out talking about Solomon and his situation and how he was unfaithful, and as a result, God was going to rip Israel away from Solomon's dynasty. Okay, from Solomon's son. But for the sake of David, Solomon's dad, who had faith in God and had a heart after God, that God was going to leave one tribe, that is Judah, with Solomon's son Rehoboam. And so we see then that the nation split. And we talked on page two, we gave some overview of some of the stuff that happened there. And then page three and four, we've talked about some of the kings. And if you look at your picture that we've been through so far, we see that the picture lists all the kings of the northern nation of Israel. And we're kind of halfway through. Really, we're kind of through the first third, but that's really basically halfway through. We see three different colors here. We see the dark area up at the top. These are the kings start up there at the top. And that reminds us that the first, say, 100 years of the Northern Kingdom's history was built around a bunch of civil strife because they basically had separated, had seceded from the United Kingdom of Israel. And then we have a time of wealth and prosperity. That's the golden color that we see in the middle. And then the red to orange, orange to red colors, that is a time of an age of rapid decline. If you look at the time frames, the age of civil strife was about 100 years, the age of wealth and prosperity about 100 years, but then the age of rapid decline, it was rapid. We're talking 20 years or so there. So we have walked so far through the kings of the age of civil strife. We started out with Jeroboam at the first, and we see that golden calf on him, and that reminds us that when he split, he didn't want his people going to Judah, going to Jerusalem to worship God because he was afraid he might lose them and the people would ally themselves with Rehoboam. So he made up his own religion and he set up temples in Dan and Bethel, okay, way up in the north and way down the south of his kingdom, and made up his own festivals and priests and all of that and led Israel away. We saw that the faithful people in Israel left, okay, the Levites and priests, the people who were faithful, they left and they went south and moved down to Judah. And that further strengthened Judah and further weakened Israel. We see that he led Israel astray, Israel stayed astray, and all these kings that we've looked at so far, and I'll tell you all the kings that we're going to look at in the Northern Kingdom, they all persist in the sins of Jeroboam and worship these golden calves. They may add a few others to them, which we see as we keep going down to Ahab, the last one we talked about, that snake on there, reminds us that it was during Ahab then that Baal worship became predominant in Israel. And that was largely the result of Ahab's wife and her influence, that is Jezebel. She was the daughter of the king of Sidon and brought Baal worship with her. Before Ahab, we see Omri, the little volcano there, and a couple of coins. That reminds us that Syria threatened Israel's freedom, really starting at Baasha, all the way down through Omri. And Israel was subject to Syria. That's what the coins mean, that kind of thing. Now, the other thing that we haven't talked about yet so much are the two staffs and flags that are sticking in Ahab. And we did mention that those are, that represents prophets. And if you look at this picture, you'll see some other prophets to come, Hosea and Amos and Isaiah. But right here we see that during the time of this rapid decline, during this time of Baalism, during this time of rejection of God, God sent two heavy hitters. The big heavy hitter, Elijah. Okay, Elijah's recognized as the top prophet. Okay, when Jesus appeared, when Jesus went on the Mount of Transfiguration and God sent a couple of guys to go give him a pep talk about this last trip he was going to make to Jerusalem where he was going to suffer and die, who did he send? Moses and Elijah. Okay, Elijah representing the prophets, Moses representing the other part of the Old Testament. So Elijah came and then Elisha followed him. And so that's what we want to talk about a little today. Now, we see that their flags are both black and white. Black talks about the doom and the gloom and the warnings and the despair that the prophets mentioned and the prophets told about because of God's judgment for the people's sin. The white is the hope that the prophets brought. And all these prophets brought some of both, but we especially see that Elijah brought warnings, trying to get Israel to come back to God. And we see a lot of hope in Elisha. And now, if you go back to last week's lesson 2, that was where we first introduced the prophets, and we talked about one of the roles of the prophets, and that is the key role. Why did God send prophets? Is to get people to come back to Him. People had rejected Him, and so He sent the prophet to bring them back, to remind them of what God called them to be, that God called them to be blessed, to be a blessing. And we see the prophet in the red and Israel there in the tan, and Israel's focused on the destiny there, but only on the first part of it, I will bless you part. All the rest of it, it's ignored, and it's fallen apart, and it's destroyed. And the prophet is there showing Israel, saying, hey, that I will bless you part is because of this, so that you will be a blessing. And all these uniting factors, all the things that God put into place to help empower and enable Israel to fulfill her destiny, Israel began to focus on those as ends in themselves rather than the means to the end of accomplishing the destiny. And so the prophet was there to point Israel back to the destiny, point Israel back to God. And that's definitely what Elijah and Elisha were sent for. So let's talk a little bit about them. There's a whole lot of neat stories about Elijah and Elisha. A lot of these are Sunday school stories that you'll remember back from your days in Sunday school. We only have time to just barely touch on them, so I recommend go through and read yourself, because you'll miss a whole lot if you don't otherwise. Now, let's talk a little bit about the gloom, doom, the judgment aspect of the prophets. And Elijah brought some of that. And we see that in various angles. The first we see when we first hear about Elijah is in 1 Kings chapter 17, verse 1. First time we hear about him, it says, now Elijah the Tishbite from Tishbe in Gilead, that's why he's called a Tishbite, because he's from Tishbe, said to Ahab, as Yahweh, the God of Israel, lives, whom I serve, there will be neither dew nor rain in the next few years except at my word. So Elijah came to Ahab. Okay, so we see that Elijah popped up during the reign of Ahab. And he goes to Ahab and says, hey, there's not going to be any more rain. It's going to stop raining. There's going to be a drought. In fact, there's not even going to be any dew from now on until I say so, until Yahweh tells me to tell you so. Now, why that particular sign? Well, because what was the Baal gods all about? The Baal gods were all about fertility, about the crops, about providing the rain that the crops needed. And Baal was the one in control of the rain. And now Elijah's coming to Ahab and saying, you worshiping Baal? Let me show you. Yahweh's the one in control. And to prove it, Yahweh's going to stop the rain. And no matter what you do in terms of calling out to Baal, that rain is not going to come until Yahweh tells me to tell you, and until Yahweh tells me to bring the rain. Okay? We also then have in 1 Kings 18 a great story of the showdown between Elijah and the Baal prophets to show who really is God. In chapter 18, verse 40, we see that after that showdown, and it was obvious that Yahweh's God and not Baal, it says that Elijah commanded the people, seize the prophets of Baal. Don't let anyone get away. They seized them, and Elijah had them brought down to the Kishon Valley and slaughtered there. So here we see the slaughter of 450 prophets of Baal. As a result of that, and obviously God's judgment against those prophets and against the Baal worship. 1 Kings chapter 21, starting at verse 19. Say to him, Well, let me start at 17. Then the word of the Lord came to Elijah the Tishbite. Go down to meet Ahab, king of Israel, who rules in Samaria. He's now in Naboth's vineyard where he has gone to take possession of it. Say to him, this is what Yahweh says. Have you not murdered a man and seized his property? Then say to him, this is what Yahweh says. In the place where dogs licked up Naboth's blood, dogs will lick up your blood. Yes, yours. Going on, Ahab said to Elijah, so you found me, my enemy. I found you, he answered, because you have sold yourself to do evil in the eyes of Yahweh. I'm going to bring disaster on you. I'm going to consume your descendants and cut off from Ahab every last male in Israel, slave or free. I'll make your house like that of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, and that of Baasha, son of Ahijah, because you have provoked me to anger and have caused Israel to sin. And also concerning Jezebel, Yahweh says, dogs will devour Jezebel by the wall of Jezreel. Dogs will eat those belonging to Ahab who die in the city, and the birds of the air will feed on those who die in the country. So here we have the pronouncement of judgment against Ahab and his family for rejecting Yahweh, not just rejecting Yahweh and following the ways of Jeroboam, but going far beyond with all the Baal worship and leading Israel astray into worshiping Baal. And so Elijah says that Ahab and his family will be totally destroyed, just like the family of Jeroboam, just like the family of Baasha that we saw in the first half of this lesson. So there we have some judgments that Elijah's given to Ahab. Now, his son Ahaziah, after Ahab died, Ahaziah took over, and we see in 2 Kings chapter 1, in verse 2, that Ahaziah fell through the lattice of his upper room in Samaria and injured himself. Okay? So he got hurt. He fell and got hurt. And he didn't know if he was going to be better or not. And what does he do? He sends messengers to consult Baalzebub, okay, who is a god, a Baal god of Ekron. We see that in verse 2. Ekron being in Philistia. So this isn't even one of his own Baals. And he sends messengers to go to consult with Baalzebub, the god of Ekron, to see if I will recover from this injury, it says. So as a judgment, I mean, this is one of the first things he can do. He does after he takes over, and Elijah brings God's judgment, because what does he do? He first turns to another god. Verse 16, Elijah told the king, this is what Yahweh says. Is it because there's no god in Israel for you to consult that you've sent messengers to consult Baalzebub, the god of Ekron? Because you've done this, you will never leave the bed that you're lying on. You will certainly die. And so he died, according to the word that Yahweh had, that Elijah had spoken. Okay? So, Ahaziah would die from the injury since he sent people to consult Baal, not to consult God. Didn't turn to God when he had a need. So, that was his judgment there. Now, it wasn't just all doom and gloom that Elijah brought. Elijah produced a lot of miracles. Elijah brought a bunch of hope as well. But we saw the power of God very powerfully through Elijah. Let's just look at some of those. Chapter 18 says, verse 1, after a long time in the third year, this is the third year of the drought that Elijah said would happen back in 17, verse 1. The word of Yahweh came to Elijah, go and present yourself to Ahab and I will send rain on the land. Okay, so now it's going to be time. And then you've got the story of the Baal prophet showdown. And then after the prophets are killed and all that, then verse 41 goes into the rest. Elijah then, after the prophets were killed in verse 40, Elijah said to Ahab, go, eat and drink, for there's a sound of a heavy rain. So Ahab went off to eat and drink. But Elijah climbed to the top of Mount Carmel, bent down to the ground, and put his face between his knees. Go and look towards the sea, he told his servant. And he went up and looked. There's nothing there, he said. Seven times Elijah said, go back. The seventh time the servant reported, a cloud as small as a man's hand is rising from the sea. So Elijah said, go tell Ahab, hitch up your chariot and go down before the rain stops you. Meanwhile, the sky grew black with clouds, the wind rose, a heavy rain came on, and Ahab rode off to Jezreel. And actually, get a little bit more miracle in the next one here. The power of the Lord came upon Elijah, and tucking his cloak into his belt, he ran ahead of Ahab all the way to Jezreel. Ahab was riding in a chariot behind a fast horse, and Elijah ran faster. So here you see some miraculous things that God does through Elijah. Now, during that drought, there were some miracles there. In chapter 17, verses 11 to 16, we see that when the drought started, eventually Elijah went to Zarephath, okay, which is over in the area of Sidon, so outside of Israelite territory. And there he met up with a widow. And starting at verse 11, as this widow was going to get some water for him that he asked for in verse 10, he called, "And bring me, please, a piece of bread." "As surely as Yahweh your God lives," she replied, "I don't have any bread, only a handful of flour in a jar and a little oil in a jug, and I'm gathering a few sticks to take home and make a meal for myself and my son that we may eat it and then die." Okay, so the drought was bad everywhere. So there was a famine as a result of the drought. Elijah said to her, "Don't be afraid. Go home and do as you've said, but first, make a small cake of bread for me from what you have and bring it to me. And then make something for yourself and your son. For this is what Yahweh, the God of Israel, says. The jar of flour will not be used up and the jug of oil will not run dry until the day that Yahweh gives rain on the land." So he's asking her to trust him. She doesn't know him from Adam, but he's asking her to trust him because he's the messenger of God. This is what God says. This is what Yahweh says. So she went away and did as Elijah had told her. So there was food every day for Elijah and for the woman and for her family. For the jar of flour was not used up and the jug of oil did not run dry in keeping with the word of the Yahweh spoken by Elijah. And then right after that, we have another miracle. Okay, so you've got that ever-flowing oil and flour for the widow in Zarephath for almost 3 years, it looks like, right? And then 17, now sometime later, the son of the woman who owned the house became ill. He grew worse and worse and finally stopped breathing. She said to Elijah, "What have you against me, man of God? Did you come to remind me of my sin and kill my son?" "Give me your son," Elijah replied. So he took him from her arms, carried him to the upper room where he was staying, and laid him on his bed. He cried out to the Lord, "Oh Lord, my God, have you brought tragedy also upon this widow that I'm staying with by causing her son to die?" Then he stretched himself on the boy three times and cried to the Lord, "Oh Lord, my God, let this boy's life return to him." The Lord heard Elijah's cry, and the boy's life returned to him, and he lived. Elijah picked up the child and carried him down from the room into the house. He gave him to his mother and said, "Look, your son's alive." Then the woman said to Elijah, "Now I know that you are a man of God, and that the word of the Lord is from your mouth is the truth." So there you see another miracle. And there you also see the purpose of miracles. Anytime you see a miracle, whether Jesus performed it or someone else, the purpose is to build faith, whether it is to start faith where faith doesn't exist or to build into a stronger faith, the faith that's there. And you see the woman's reaction here. It built her faith. Other miracles. Well, let's look a little bit at the Baal prophet showdown that we talked about a little bit. And this is a very interesting story. It starts in chapter 18, and after this drought's been going on some time, then God tells Elijah at the beginning of chapter 18 to go show yourself to Ahab, and so we see him meet him in verse 16. Ahab went to meet Elijah, and when he saw Elijah, he said, "Is that you, you troubler of Israel?" "I haven't made trouble for Israel," Elijah replied, "but you and your father's family have. You've abandoned the Lord's command and you've followed the Baals. Now, summon the people from all over Israel to meet me on Mount Carmel and bring the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table." Okay, so he meets Ahab, and Ahab saying, "This guy's the trouble. He's the reason we haven't had any rain." But Ahab wants to do what Elijah says because Elijah's the one who's going to be able to bring the rain. So Elijah says, "Bring all the prophets and bring them to Mount Carmel, and then I'll tell you what we're going to do." And so Ahab does that. Okay, verse 20, he sends word through all Israel and assembled the prophets on Mount Carmel. And then we'll skip ahead to verse, and we'll go to 33. We will go to 22, Elijah says to the people, now I'm the only one of the Lord's prophets left, but Baal has 450 prophets. So get two bulls for us. Let them choose one for themselves and let them cut it into pieces and put it on the wood, but not set fire to it. I'll prepare the other bull and put it on the wood, but not set fire to it. Then you call on the name of your God, and I'll call on the name of Yahweh, the God who answers by fire. He's God. Then all the people said, hey, good idea. What you say is good. So that was going to be the showdown. That was it. So he said to the prophets of Baal, verse 25, y'all go first, okay, since there's so many of you. So they took the bull given to him and prepared it, verse 26, and they called on the name of Baal from morning until noon. Oh, Baal, answer us, they shouted. But there was no response. No one answered, because there is no one. There's no Baal. And they danced around the altar that they'd made. At noon, Elijah began to taunt them. Shout louder, he said. Surely he's a god. Perhaps he's deep in thought or busy or traveling. Maybe he's sleeping and must be awakened. So they shouted louder and slashed themselves with swords and spears as their custom was until their blood flowed. Midday passed and they continued their frantic prophesying until the time for the evening sacrifice. But there was no response. No one answered. No one paid attention. Well, then Elijah said to all the people, okay, y'all come here. They came to him, and he repaired the altar of the Lord, which was in ruins. He took 12 stones, one for each of the tribes, and with the stones he built an altar in the name of Yahweh, dug a trench around it large enough to hold 2 seahs of seed. That's about 13 quarts. Okay, he arranged the wood, cut the bull into pieces, laid it on the wood. Then he said, okay, fill 4 large jars with water and pour it on the offering and on the wood. Okay, so I want you all to know there's no tricks up my sleeve here. So wet wood doesn't light, right? So pour water all over everything. And they did it. He said, okay, then do it again. And do it again. So they did it the third time. And by this time, so much water had been poured that this little trench around the altar that he had dug filled up with water. Which that had to be a lot of water because that ground was dry after nearly 3 years of no rain. So the water would have just soaked in. So now it's saturated, and so there's lots of water all over this. Then at the time of sacrifice, Elijah stepped forward and prayed to God. And he says, verse 37, answer me, O Lord, answer me, so that these people will know that you, O Lord, are God. And you are turning their hearts back again. Then the fire of Yahweh fell and burned up the sacrifice, and the wood, and the stones, and the soil, and also licked up the water in the trench. When all the people saw this, they fell prostrate and cried, Yahweh, He is God. Yahweh, He is God. So Elijah's purpose had been met here. The people recognize that Yahweh is God. Baal is not God, but Yahweh is God. In fact, to show that that was Elijah's purpose, that's what Elijah's name means. El means God. Yah is short for Yahweh. Yahweh is God. Yahweh is God is what his name is. And so that's what basically what they're calling out here. Eliyah, Eliyah, Yahweh is God, Elijah. Okay. So here we see the impact that he has on the people through this showdown and through that miracle. 2 Kings chapter 1, verses 9 to 15. This is after Ahaziah has fallen through the lattice and is injured. And this is before Elijah tells him that he's going to die from his injuries because he consulted Beelzebub. Okay? But what happens is, in verse 6, it says, a man came to me to say, replied, and he said, go back and tell the king who sent you and tell him, this is what Yahweh says. Is it because there's no God in Israel that you are sending men to consult Beelzebub, the God of Ekron? Therefore, you will not leave the bed you're lying on. You will certainly die. Okay? So he had sent word back with Ahaziah's men to tell Ahaziah that. The king asked him, verse 7, what kind of man was it that came to meet you and told you this? They replied, well, he is a man with a garment of hair and a leather belt around his waist. The king said, well, that's Elijah the Tishbite. So he sent to Elijah a captain with his company of 50 men. The captain went up to Elijah, who was sitting on top of a hill, and said to him, man of God, the king says, come down. Elijah answered the captain, if I'm a man of God, may fire come down from heaven and consume you and your 50 men. So then fire fell from heaven and consumed the captain and his men. Okay, so you see that captain was saying, hey, the king says this, you gotta come. Okay, and God, and Elijah says, the king's nobody compared to God. At this, the king sent to Elijah another captain with his 50 men. The captain said to him, man of God, this is what the king says, come down at once. Okay, make it even stronger, at once. If I'm a man of God, Elijah replied, may fire come down from heaven and consume you and your 50 men. Then the fire of God fell from heaven and consumed him and his 50 men. Okay, you seeing a pattern here? Well, so verse 13, the king sends a third captain with his 50 men. Okay, how would you like to be that third captain or one of his 50 men? The third captain went up and fell on his knees before Elijah. Man of God, he begged, please have respect for my life and the lives of these 50 men, your servants. See, fire has fallen from heaven and consumed the first two captains and all their men, but now have respect for my life. The angel of Yahweh said to Elijah, okay, go down with him. Don't be afraid of him. So Elijah got up and went down with him to the king. So you see the fire from God coming down on two companies of men from Ahaziah here. So you see God producing that miracle. And then one other miracle I'll point out. Chapter 2, verse 8, we see that Elijah took his cloak, rolled it up, and struck the water with it, you know, kind of like the pops you do in the high school boys' locker rooms, okay? And the water divided to the right and to the left, and the two of them, Elijah and Elisha, crossed over on dry ground. So there you see the same sort of miracle that Joshua did, parting the water in the Jordan River, crossing over on dry ground. Same sort of miracle that Moses did back in the Sea of Reeds, the Red Sea. Okay, a couple other things we'll look at real quick on Elijah to finish off Elijah is how God took care of him. During that drought, we've already seen how he went to Zarephath near Sidon, but before that, before he went there, we see in the first verses of chapter 17 that after he told Ahab that there would be no rain, then in verse 2, the word of the Lord came to Elijah, leave here, turn eastward and hide, because Ahab's going to be looking for you, in the Kereth Ravine east of the Jordan, and he stayed there. And hide in the Kereth Ravine east of the Jordan. You will drink from the brook, and I have ordered the ravens to feed you there. So he did what the Lord had told him. He went to the Kereth Ravine east of the Jordan and stayed there. The ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning, and bread and meat in the evening, and he drank from the brook. So here he's being provided for, just as the Israelites were provided for in the desert all those 40 years with manna, what is it, and quail. God uses his creation to provide for Elijah during this time of drought. Chapter 19. Well, after, let me just start verse 1. It tells you about it. Now, Ahab told Jezebel everything that Elijah had done with the Baal prophet showdown, and how he had killed all the prophets with a sword. So Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah to say, may the gods deal with me, be it ever so severely, if by this time tomorrow I do not make your life like one of them. Elijah was afraid and ran for his life. When he came to Beersheba in Judah, he left his servant there while he went himself a day's journey into the desert. He came to a broom tree, sat down under it, and prayed that he might die. He said, I've had enough, Lord. Take my life. I'm no better than my ancestors. Then he laid down under the tree and fell asleep. All at once, an angel touched him and said, get up and eat. He looked around, and there by his head was a cake of bread baked over hot coals and a jar of water. He ate and drank and then lay down again. The angel of the Lord came back a second time and touched him and said, get up and eat, for the journey is too much for you. So he got up and ate and drank. Strengthened by that food, he traveled 40 days and 40 nights until he reached Horeb, the mountain of God. There he went into a cave and spent the night. So here you've got this journey that he takes to go to Mount Sinai, Mount Horeb, from the northern part of Israel. And it involves traveling across the desert where there's no food and no water. And God provides for him through this angel to give him the strength to be able to go there. So you see God caring for him and taking care of him. And then he gets to Sinai. This is very interesting. Verse 11, the Lord says, go and stand on the mountain in the presence of the Lord, for the Lord's about to pass by. Then a great and powerful wind tore the mountains apart and shattered the rocks before the Lord, but the Lord was not in the wind. After the wind, there was an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. After the earthquake came a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire came a gentle whisper. When Elijah heard it, he pulled his cloak over his face and went out and stood at the mouth of the cave. And then a voice said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" So you see how God spoke to Elijah. Elijah was scared to death. Elijah was ready to give up. He said, "Take my life." We read that in verse 4. "I've had enough, Lord. Take my life. I'm no better than my ancestors. I quit. I've had enough. This prophet business is too tough. That's enough." And then on top of that, verse 10, he says, "I've been very zealous for Yahweh, God Almighty. The Israelites have rejected your covenants, broken down your altars, and put your prophets to death with the sword. I am the only one left. And now they're trying to kill me too." So he thought he was a lone ranger. He thought he was the only one faithful in all of Israel. And he couldn't do it anymore. He just broke. He just couldn't do it. And so God comes to him and God speaks to him in this gentle whisper. And then what's interesting is, verse 18, he says, "Elijah, I reserve 7,000 in Israel, all whose knees have not bowed to Baal and all whose mouths have not kissed him." So you're not the Lone Ranger. You're not the only one. There's 7,000 that you don't know about that are faithful to me. Okay. So he encourages him with that. And he tells him, these other verses here that I didn't read, "I got some other stuff for you to do. You need to go and anoint some people and anoint your successor," that kind of thing. We'll read that in a second. One other thing, the last thing where we see God taking care of Elijah, which is a very unique thing, verse 11, as Elijah and Elisha, this is chapter 2 of 2 Kings, verse 11, "As Elijah and Elisha were walking along and talking together, suddenly a chariot of fire and horses of fire appeared and separated the two of them. And Elijah went up to heaven in a whirlwind." So Elijah was taken alive. We don't see that Elijah ever died. He was taken alive in this chariot of fire, whirlwind thing, and Elisha got to see it. Okay? So let's talk about Elisha. Okay, now Elijah, you see in your notes there, Elijah was prophet during the time of Ahab and Ahaziah. We've seen that in those stories that we just read. Okay? Elisha then came and was the prophet to the next kings, okay? To Jehoram, to Jehu, to Jehoahaz, and to Jehoash, okay? So we'll see some of that as we go through here. Now, how did he get to be the successor to Elijah? Did he apply? Was it a contest? How did all that work? 1 Kings chapter 19 says, we see in verse 16, this is when Elijah is on Mount Sinai, the verses that we just read a bit ago. And he says, "Go and anoint Elisha, son of Shaphat, from Abel-Meholah, to succeed you as prophet." So God had already picked Elisha. Why was Elisha in training to be a prophet? We'll take a look at when he meets him, verse 21. So Elisha... verse 19. So Elijah went from there and found Elisha, son of Shaphat. He was plowing with 12 yoke of oxen, and he himself was driving the 12th pair. Elijah went up to him and threw his cloak around him, saying, "This is my mantle, this is now you, you're my successor." That was symbolic of that. And what do you see? Elisha was just a regular person. He was out farming, okay? One of numerous farmers. There were 12 yoke of oxen, and he was just one of them, doing one of the plow jobs. Okay, so that's how he became the successor to Elijah. Now, he especially inherited something very special from Elijah that he asked for, and it wasn't really Elijah's to give. It was God's to give, and Elijah made it clear how he would know for sure. We see that in 2 Kings chapter 2. Verse 9, "When they had crossed over the Jordan River, Elijah said to Elisha, 'Tell me, what can I do for you before I'm taken from you?' 'Let me inherit a double portion of your spirit,' Elisha replied." Now, a double portion was the portion that was for an inheritance, for instance, the oldest son would receive a double share. So like if there were three sons, rather than dividing up the inheritance into thirds and giving each one a third, the oldest son would get, they would divide it into fourths, and the oldest son would get two-fourths, and each of the others one-fourth. And there's a lot of reasons for that as far as, you know, the responsibilities and costs that that son then had to carry on the family business and family, et cetera, leadership, all that. But he said, I want to be your heir, is what he's saying here. I want a double portion of your spirit, which his spirit was the Holy Spirit, right? So that's a very powerful thing. So Elijah said, you have asked a difficult thing. I'll tell you what, I can't do it, but God can. And if you see me when I'm taken from you, then it'll be yours. Otherwise not. Okay, so that'll be God's sign to you that you will receive a double portion of my spirit. So he did. He got to see, which in the verses we just kind of read a little bit ago, he saw Elijah taken from him. And then we see it evident in his life. 2 Kings chapter 6, 15 to 18 is a very interesting story. And this is where the Arameans are surrounding Israel. And starting at verse 15, when the servant of the man of God got up and went out early the next morning, an army with horses and chariots had surrounded the city. Oh my Lord, what shall we do? The servant asked. Okay, this is a servant of Elisha. Don't be afraid, the prophet answered. Those who are with us are more than those who are with them. Okay, and the servant's going, what are you talking about? There's so many of them out there and there's nobody here. And Elisha prayed, oh Lord, open his eyes so he may see. And the Lord opened the servant's eyes and he looked and saw the hills full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. So Elisha had seen that. Elisha knew that was there. He could see what others couldn't see because he was filled with the Spirit. And so these horses and chariots that God sent to protect Israel from the Syrian army, Elisha saw that, what other people couldn't see. All right? And then even after Elisha's death, that double portion of Elijah's spirit was evident. Take a look at the story in 2 Kings chapter 13, starting at verse 20. It says, Elisha died and was buried. Now, Moabite raiders used to enter the country every spring. Once, while some Israelites were burying a man, suddenly they saw a band of raiders. So they threw the man's body into Elisha's tomb. When the body touched Elisha's bones, the man came to life and stood up on his feet. So this man was resurrected just by touching the dead bones of Elisha. Okay? So you see the presence of God there, or at least that's what God is symbolizing and pointing out there. All right, let's look at some of his miracles. Okay, we looked at a lot of miracles with Elijah. There's a whole bunch of them with Elisha. Chapter 2, verse 13, he picked up the cloak that had fallen from Elijah. Okay, so when Elijah was taken up in the chariot, his cloak fell, and Elisha picked it up. This is the same cloak that Elijah had used to pop the water and split the Jordan River. So Elisha went back and stood on the bank of the Jordan. Then he took the cloak that had fallen from Elijah and struck the water with it. Where now is Yahweh, the God of Elijah? He asked. Then he struck the water. When he struck the water, it divided to the right and to the left, and he crossed over, just like Elijah had done. So you've got that power there and the miracle, same miracle that Elijah had there. Verse 19, the men of the city said to Elisha, look, our Lord, this town is well situated, as you can see, but the water is bad. The land is unproductive. Bring me a new bowl, he said, and put some salt in it. So they brought it to him. Then he went out to the spring and threw the salt into it, saying, this is what the Lord says. I have healed this water. Never again will it cause death or make the land unproductive. And the waters remain wholesome to this day, according to the word Elisha had spoken. When you put salt in water, does that make it better? No, it's salty. You go to the ocean, you really can't drink it because it's not, it'll dehydrate you, okay, because of all the salt. If you take salt water and put it on plants, what happens? You kill them. But instead, here, he took salt and that made the water good. So again, you see this miracle here being produced. The next verses here are verses that Roger Carr likes and offers as a warning to people. From there, Elisha went up to Bethel. As he was walking along the road, some youths came out of the town and jeered at him, "Go on up, you bald head! Go on up, you bald head!" He turned around, looked at them, and called down a curse on them in the name of the Lord. Then two bears came out of the woods and mauled 42 of the youths. Okay, so just him giving a little curse, 42 of them got mauled by bears after teasing Elisha for having a bald head. Okay, chapter 3. Here we have a revolt from Moab. Okay, Moab had been subject to Israel. And after Ahab died in verse 5, the king of Moab rebelled against the king of Israel. So at that time, King Joram sent out from Samaria and mobilized all of Israel and goes out to fight. And we see that after a roundabout march in verse 9 of 7 days, the army had no more water for themselves or for the animals with them. Okay, they're out in this desert area, in the desert of Eden, we see in verse 8, and they got no food, no water. They got no water. So they're all going to die. So what do they do? Verse 16. The word of the Lord came upon Elisha, and he said, "This is what Yahweh says. Make this valley full of ditches." Okay, just dig a bunch of ditches. Okay, what good is that going to do in the desert? It's just sand, right? "For this is what the Lord says. You will neither see wind nor rain, yet this valley will be filled with water, and you, your cattle, and your other animals will drink." So he told them to dig up a bunch of ditches. And then that next morning, verse 20, about the time for offering the sacrifice, there it was. Water flowing from the direction of Edom, and the land was filled with water. So they were able to drink. So they got the miracle of water, ditches of water being filled out in the desert. Then later on, what happens then, in verse 22, the Moabites got up early in the morning, and the sun was shining on that water. To the Moabites across the way, the water looked red like blood. "That's blood," they said. "Those kings must have fought and slaughtered each other. Now to the plunder, Moab." But when the Moabites came to the camp of Israel, the Israelites rose up and fought them until they fled. And the Israelites invaded the land and slaughtered the Moabites. So these ditches of water then looked like blood. They came thinking that they were going to take the plunder. They weren't ready to fight. The Israelites fought, and Israel won that battle because of this miracle here. Okay, through Elisha. We also see some other similar sorts of miracles than what we saw with Elijah. We see in chapter 4 that a wife from a man of the company of the prophets cried out to Elisha, "Your servant, my husband's dead, and you know that he revered Yahweh, but now his creditor is coming to take my two boys as a slaves." Elisha replied to her, "How can I help you? Tell me, what do you have in your house?" "Well, your servant has nothing there at all except just a little oil." He said, "Go around and ask all your neighbors for empty jars. Don't just ask for a few. Then go inside and shut the door behind you and your sons. Pour oil into all the jars, and as each is filled, put it to one side." She left them and afterwards shut the door behind her and her sons. They brought the jars to her. She kept pouring. When all the jars were full of oil, she said to her son, "Bring me another one." He said, "There's no more. There's no more jars." Then the oil stopped flowing. She went and told the man of God, "Go sell the oil and pay your debts," he said. "You and your sons can live on what is left." Okay, so he had this ever-flowing oil, kind of like the oil and the flour for that Elijah did for the widow at Zarephath. Here we have this widow being able to save her sons from slavery from this. We also have another similar story. This he gets a place to stay, a well-to-do woman in verse 8 in Shunem, gives him a place to stay whenever he comes to town, and sets up, let's make a small room on the roof in verse 10 and put it in a bed and a table and a chair and a lamp for him, and that way he can stay there whenever he comes. So one time he came, and verse 14, he says, "What can be done for her? She's been so nice to me." Well, Gehazi, his servant, Elisha's servant, said, "Well, she's got no son and her husband's old." Then Elisha said, "Call her." So he called her, and she stood in the doorway. About this time next year, Elisha said, "You will hold a son in your arms." "No, my lord," she objected. "Don't mislead your servant, O man of God." But the woman became pregnant, and the next year, about that same time, she gave birth to a son, just as Elisha had told her. So this miraculous birth Elisha brought is a miracle. But then, what happens? Kind of similar to Elijah. Verse 32. When Elisha reached the house, there was that boy lying dead on his couch. Elisha went in, shut the door on the two of them, and prayed to the Lord. He got on the bed, laid upon the boy, mouth to mouth, eyes to eyes, hands to hands, and as he stretched himself upon him, the boy's body grew warm. Elisha turned away and walked back and forth in the room, then got on the bed and stretched out on him once more. The boy sneezed seven times and opened his eyes. So here you see the woman's son died, and Elisha raised him from the dead, just like Elijah had done for the widow of Zarephath's son. Some other miracles, okay? Verse 39. One of the men of the company of prophets went out into the fields to gather herbs and found a wild vine. He gathered some of its gourds and filled the fold of his cloak. When he returned, he cut them into the pot of stew, though no one knew what they were. The stew was poured out for the men. As they began to eat it, they cried out, "Oh, man of God, there's death in the pot," and they couldn't eat it. Elisha said, "Get some flour." He put it in the pot and said, "Okay, serve it to the people to eat," and there was nothing harmful in the pot, okay? So he healed this poisonous death in the pot so that the prophets could eat. Verse 42, a man came from Baal Shalemeshah, bringing the man of God 20 loaves of barley bread baked from the first ripe grain along with some heads of new grain. "Give it to the people to eat," Elisha said. "How can I set this before 100 men?" his servant answered. But Elisha said, "Give it to the people to eat, for this is what the Lord says. They will eat and have some left over." And he set it before them, and they ate and had some left over, according to the word of the Lord. So this is a much smaller version of what we see later with Jesus in feeding the 5,000. But you see this kind of miracle here with Elisha. Chapter 5. Interesting story in chapter 5 of Naaman, the commander of the army of the king of Aram. Okay, so the enemy, the commander of the enemy. And he was a great man in the sight of his master, highly regarded, because through him Yahweh had given victory to Aram. He was a valiant soldier, but he had leprosy. So he then comes to Israel because he's got a servant girl, we see in verse 2, from Israel. And she says, "If only my master," in verse 3, "would see the prophet who's in Samaria, he would cure him of his leprosy." And so he goes. He goes to Elisha. In verse 10, Elisha sent a messenger to say to him, "Go, wash yourself seven times in the Jordan, and your flesh will be restored, and you will be cleansed." And then you got this story how Naaman was angry in verse 11 because, gosh, there's so many better rivers in Syria. What's this deal of going to the Jordan? And plus, he didn't even come out and say hi to me. He just sent this messenger. So he was mad. And his servant said, "Hey, you know, if the prophets told you to do some great thing, wouldn't you have done it? Well, how much more then when he tells you to go wash and be cleansed, go do it." So he goes, dips himself in the Jordan seven times as the man of God had told him, and his flesh was restored and became clean like that of a young boy. So here we have Naaman, the Syrian commander, being cured of leprosy by following the instructions that Elisha gave him to wash in the Jordan. Chapter 6, verses 5 and 6. Okay, a little one, but just an interesting little miracle. As one of them was cutting down a tree, these are these prophets that were cutting down a tree, doing some work by the River Jordan here. The iron axe head fell into the water. "Oh, my Lord," he cried out, "it was borrowed." The man of God says, "Okay, where'd it fall?" He showed him the place. Elisha cut a stick and threw it in there and made the iron float. Lifted out, and the man took it out. And so... How can an axe head float? It can't. It's iron. It's heavy. But here you have this little miracle here where Elisha made that happen. Verse 8. Here we have, let me just kind of go into some of this. The king of Aram was at war with Israel. After conferring with his officers, he said, "I'll set up my camp in such and such a place." The man of God sent word to the king of Israel, "Beware of passing that place because the Arameans are going down there." So the king of Israel checked on the place indicated by the man of God. Time and again, Elisha warned the king so that he was on his guard in such places. This enraged the king of Aram. He summoned his officers and demanded of them, "Will you not tell me which of us is on the side of the king of Israel?" Who's telling the king of Israel where we're going to be? How's this leaking out? "None of us, my lord the king," said one of his officers, "but Elisha the prophet who's in Israel tells the king of Israel the very words that you speak in your bedroom." he was able to know the private plans of the Syrian king and thereby warn the king of Israel from that. Then they find out that Elisha's in Dothan, okay? Verse 13, so he's the king of Aram, the king of Syria, sends his horses and chariots and a strong force to Dothan, and they surround the city. When the servant of the man of God got up and went out early next morning, an army with horses and chariots had surrounded him, and said, "Oh Lord, what shall we do?" And this is the verse that we read before where he said, "There's more of us than there are of them." He says, "What do you mean?" And he opened his eyes and he saw the hills full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. Then the enemy came down toward him. Elisha prayed to the Lord, "Strike these people with blindness." So he struck them with blindness as Elisha had asked. Elisha told them, "This isn't the road and this isn't the city. Follow me and I'll lead you to the man that you're looking for." And he led them to Samaria. He took the Syrian army to Samaria. They entered the city, verse 20. And then after they were in the city, Elisha said, "Lord, open the eyes of these men so they can see." The Lord opened their eyes and they looked, and there they were inside the national capital of Israel, Samaria. You've got this leading the Syrian army into capture here. And this ended the Syrian raids here. They let them go rather than killing them. When the king of Israel saw them, he asked Elisha in verse 21, "Shall I kill them?" "Don't kill them," he answered. "Would you kill men that you've captured with your own sword or bow? Set food and water before them so they can eat and drink and then go back to their master." And so they went back, and then it says, so the bands from Aram stopped raiding Israel's territory. So it brought peace as a result of that. And then later, we've then got a famine there. Sometime later, Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, mobilized his entire army and marched up and laid siege to Samaria. There was a great famine in the city. The siege lasted so long that a donkey's head sold for 80 shekels of silver and a quarter of a cab of seed pods for 5 shekels. Then in chapter 7, at verse 1, Elisha says, "Hear the word of the Lord. This is what the Lord says. About this time tomorrow, a sea of flour will sell for a shekel and 2 seas of barley for a shekel at the gate of Samaria." The officer on whom the king was, whose arm the king was leaning, said to the man of God, "Look, even if the Lord should open the floodgates of the heavens, how could this happen?" "You'll see it with your own eyes," answered Elisha, "but you will not eat any of it." And then we see what happens in the next story, where the Arameans get spooked and scared, and they run off, and these men find the empty camps and bring the people. And then verse 16, the people went out and plundered the camp of the Arameans. So a sea of flour sold for a shekel and 2 seas of barley sold for a shekel as the Lord had said through Elisha. Now the king had put the officer on whose arm he had leaned before in charge of the gate, and the people trampled him in the gateway and he died, just as the man of God had foretold when the king came down to his house. Okay. So here we see some prophecies. Here you see he knew what was going to happen because God revealed it. He knew in the midst of this siege, in the midst of this no food and outrageous prices for just the tiniest bit of anything to eat, he said, "This time tomorrow, food's going to be so cheap," okay? And nobody could believe it, but that's what happened. And he even foretold the death of that that officer there. Other prophecies, other where God spoke through him. Chapter 8. Elisha had said to the woman whose son he had restored to life. This is the Shunammite woman that we studied before. "Go away with your family and stay for a while wherever you can, because the Lord has decreed a famine in the land that will last for 7 years. The woman proceeded to do as a man of God said. She and her family went away and stayed in the land of Philistines for 7 years. Okay? So here he prophesied this famine before it happened and thereby protected this Shunammite woman that had taken care of him so well. And then verse 6, we see that when she comes back after that 7 years, she comes back for her house and her land. The king asked the woman about it, and she told him. Then he assigned an official to her case and said to him, "Give her back everything that belonged to her, including all the income from her land from the day she left the country until now." So she was taken care of through that as well. Okay, verse 9, but we'll start in verse 7. Elisha went to Damascus, and Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, was ill. So he goes to the enemy's area here, okay? When the king was told that the man of God has come all the way up here, he said to Hazael, take a gift with you and go meet the man of God. Consult Yahweh through him and ask, will I recover from this illness? I think that's interesting because remember Ahaziah, Ahab's son, consulted Beelzebub, the god of Ekron, when he got injured. And now here we have the king of Syria consulting the prophet of God, the prophet of Yahweh, Elisha, okay, when he's injured and when he wants to know if he's going to be healed. Well, Hazael went to meet Elisha, taking with him as a gift 40 camel loads of all the finest wares of Damascus. He went in and stood before him and said, your son Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, has sent me to ask, will I recover from this illness? Elisha answered, go and say to him, you will certainly recover. But, you know, Yahweh has told me that he will in fact die. And then he stared at him with a fixed gaze until Hazael felt ashamed. The man of God began to cry. Why are you crying? Asked Hazael. Because I know the harm that you will do the Israelites. You'll set fire to their fortified palaces. You'll kill their young men with the sword, dash their little children to the ground, rip open their pregnant women. How could your servant, a mere dog, accomplish such a feat? Well, the Lord has shown me that you will become king of Aram, answered Elisha. So here Elisha's foretelling to this guy that Ben-Hadad was going to die, and Hazael would replace him as king. Going on verse 14, then Hazael left Elisha and returned to his master. When Ben-Hadad said, what did Elisha say to you? He said, you would certainly recover. But the next day, Hazael took a thick cloak, soaked it in water, and spread it over the king's face so that he died. And then Hazael succeeded him as king, just as Elisha had said would happen. Okay, so here you have the insights of God through Elisha. Then 2 Kings chapter 9, verses 1 to 3, the prophet Elisha summoned a man from the company of the prophets and said to him, tuck your cloak into your belt, take this flask of oil with you, and go to Ramoth-Gilead. When you get there, look for Jehu, son of Jehoshaphat, the son of Nimshi. Go to him and get him away from his companions and take him into an inner room. Then take the flask, pour the oil on his head, and declare, this is what Yahweh says, I anoint you king over Israel. Then open the door and run. Don't delay. So Elisha had Jehu anointed as king over Israel to replace Joram, who was the son of Ahab. Okay? And so he knew because God was telling him, God working through Elisha here. One more and we'll be done with the Elisha stories here. 2 Kings chapter 13, starting at verse 15. This is Elisha with Jehoash, the king of Israel. And Elisha was dying, and there was troubles. And so Elisha told him, verse 15, get a bow and some arrows, and he did so. Take the bow in your hands, he said to the king of Israel. When he had taken it, Elisha put his hands on the king's hands. Open the east window, he said, and he opened it. So he's following what Elisha says. Shoot, Elisha said, and he shot. The Lord's arrow of victory, the arrow of victory over Aram, Elisha declared, you will completely destroy the Arameans at Aphek. Then he said, take the arrows, and the king took them. Elisha told him, strike the ground. He struck it three times and stopped. The man of God was angry with him and said, you should have struck the ground five or six times. Then you would have defeated Aram and completely destroyed it. But now you'll defeat it only three times. Okay, so he prophesied Jehoash would have these successes over Syria with these arrow. So there we have these prophets, these great prophets of Elijah and Elisha that God sent during this dismal time of Israel, where they really needed to be called back to God. Okay? So, let's pick back up there. We had stopped about Ahab, okay, where we have these prophets identified. And let's look at the next one. The next one was Ahaziah. So we'll go backwards now to 1 Kings chapter 22. And let's see who was Ahaziah and how faithful was his reign. Chapter 22, verses 51 to 52. Ahaziah, son of Ahab, became king of Israel and Samaria in the 17th year of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, and he reigned over Israel for 2 years. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord because he walked in the ways of his father and mother and in the ways of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, who caused Israel to sin. So you see, he was Ahab's son. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He continued the practices of Jeroboam. But also, verse 53, he served and worshipped Baal and provoked the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger, just as his father had done. So he followed his father's practices of worshiping Baal. So if we look at our chart on the back, on page 10 here, we see that he was bad. Ahaziah was bad. But we also see that he was only king there for 2 years. Why? Well, he got hurt when he fell through the lattice. And why didn't God heal Ahaziah from the injuries from falling through the lattice? We've already talked about it, but verse 16 again. Elisha told the king, this is what the Lord says. Is it because there's no God in Israel for you to consult, that you sent messengers to consult Baalzebub, the god of Ekron? Because you've done this, you will never leave the bed that you're lying on. You will certainly die. Here, even the god of Jeroboam wasn't enough. Even the god of the Baals of Sidon that his father had worshipped weren't enough. Instead, he adds to that Baalzebub, the god of Ekron. Okay? So that was Ahaziah. Okay, after Ahaziah died from his injuries, then who took over? And how faithful was his reign? 2 Kings chapter 3, verses 1 to 2. Joram, son of Ahab, became king of Israel and Samaria in the 18th year of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, and he reigned for 12 years. So we see that one of Ahaziah's brothers, okay, another son of Ahab, became the king. Okay, so Joram, we'll also see him listed as Jehoram. You'll see it both ways. It says in verse 2, he did evil in the eyes of the Lord, but not as his father and mother had done, because he had gotten rid of the sacred stone of Baal that his father had made. So we see he's a little bit better than Ahab and Ahaziah, because he stopped the Baal worship. But verse 3, nevertheless, he clung to the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, which he caused Israel to commit. He did not turn away from them. So even though he got rid of the Baal worship, he did not get rid of the Jehoshaphat religion worship and was faithless in God's eyes. So if you look at our chart on page 10, you see we have that listed as bad mostly because he did some reforms getting rid of the Baal, but he did not get rid of the golden calves of Jeroboam, and that's what they continued to worship. All right. Now, while you're looking at the chart on page 10, you'll notice something else. There's a Jehoram here on the north side. There's also a Jehoram around the same time over on the south. That's not the same guy. Okay, it's a different Jehoram. And we see that in 2 Kings chapter 8, verse 18. And actually starting back in verse 16, in the fifth year of Joram, son of Ahab, king of Israel, when Jehoshaphat was king of Judah, then Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, began his reign as king of Judah. So it's a different Jehoram. This is a Jehoram that's the son of Jehoshaphat versus the Joram that's the son of Ahab. Okay, verse 18, he walked in the ways of the kings of Israel as the house of Ahab had done because he married a daughter of Ahab. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He had married, this Jehoram of Judah had married Athaliah, the daughter of Ahab. And so there we get some common naming. There's some relations. We'd already seen Ahab and Jehoshaphat teaming together to go to battle together and some of that support. So we're talking the same name, but two different people. Likewise, there's an Ahaziah. Okay, in the south, after Jehoram was an Ahaziah. And that's different than the Ahaziah that we've seen in the north. Verse 26. Okay, actually I start in 25. In the 12th year of Joram, son of Ahab, king of Israel, Ahaziah, son of Jehoram, king of Judah, began to reign. Ahaziah was 22 years old when he became king, reigned Jerusalem 1 year. His mother's name was Athaliah, a granddaughter of Omri, king of Israel. So there we see a different Ahaziah. This was Jehoram's of Judah's son, named Ahaziah, who became king of Judah. Okay, so there's a good risk that you can get those two confused. So I wanted to point that out to you, that they are different people, even though they've got the same basic names there. Okay, now, in chapter 3 of 2 Kings, right after Joram takes over, Moab decides that they don't like being subject to Israel anymore, and so they revolt. Okay, so let's take a look at that. Verse 4, now Mesha, king of Moab, raised sheep, and he had to supply the king of Israel with 100,000 lambs and the wool of 100,000 rams. But after Ahab died, the king of Moab rebelled against the king of Israel. So at that time, King Joram sent out from Samaria and mobilized all of Israel. He also sent this message to Jehoshaphat, king of Judah. The king of Moab has rebelled against me. Will you go with me to fight against Moab? I will go with you, he replied. I am as you are, and my people is your people, and my horses is your horses. So we see this alliance now between the north and the south, and that's why it's changed from the dark color of the civil strife to now that civil strife is gone because the north and the south are working together. And so we've got this wealth and prosperity time that comes in at this time. Let's go on through. So verse 8, by what route should we attack, he asked. Through the desert of Edom, he answered. So the king of Israel set out with the king of Judah and the king of Edom. After a roundabout march of 7 days, the army had no more water for themselves or the animals with them. So here we see Joram's response to the rejection of Moab, of being subject to Israel. And so he mobilizes his army. He teams up with his ally to the south, with Judah, and even with Edom, to go fight against the Moabites. Now, we've studied that story. This is a story where they dug the ditches and the ditches filled with water, so it gave them something to drink, but also the Moabites saw that was blood, and so they came to the plunder, but ended up getting routed, and so there's a great victory there. Why did God give Joram, this pagan king of the north, success against Moab? Verse 13, Elisha said to the king of Israel, what do we have to do with each other? You go to the prophets of your father and the prophets of your mother. No, the king of Israel answered, because it was Yahweh who called us three kings together to hand us over to Moab. Elisha said, as surely as the Lord Almighty lives, whom I serve, if I didn't have respect for the presence of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, I would not even look at you or even notice you. Okay? So because of the presence, because of the alliance, because of the relationship that Joram had with Jehoshaphat, God intervened and God supported this victory, brought this victory for Joram. How else was Joram helped? Through Elisha. 2 Kings chapter 6, verses 19 to 20. This will sound familiar from our stories. Elisha told them, this is not the road, this is not the city. Follow me and I'll lead you to the man you're looking for. And he led them to Samaria. And this is the Syrian army that had come to, come looking for Elisha. And Elisha led them into Samaria. As they entered the city, Elisha said, Lord, open the eyes of these men so they can see. Lord, open their eyes. They looked, and there they were inside of Samaria. Okay. So Elisha led the Syrian army into capture. And this resulted, as we said before, that in the ending of the raids that the Arameans had been doing against the Israelites. And then, verses 24 on, this is that story of the famine during the siege, and where he said that food's going to be so cheap and all of that. So you've got that story already, the miraculous end of the famine from the Syrian siege. That was during Joram's reign as king. Okay? One other story about Joram, we see in 2 Kings chapter 28. This is some other help that Joram received. 28 and 29. Ahaziah. Okay, this is Ahaziah, the king of Judah. Okay, so if you look down at your page 10, you see that Ahaziah there. Ahaziah went with Joram, son of Ahab, to war against Hazael, king of Aram, at Ramoth-Gilead. The Arameans wounded Joram, so King Joram returned to Jezreel to recover from the wounds that the Arameans had inflicted on him at Ramoth in his battle with Hazael, king of Aram. Then Ahaziah, son of Jehoram, king of Judah, went down to Jezreel to see Joram, son of Ahab, because he had been wounded. So the point there is that Ahaziah, the king of Judah, joined with Joram to fight against Hazael of Syria. And that was when Joram was, we find out later, mortally wounded in battle there. So there again we see the continued with other kings, not just with Jehoshaphat, but on to the other Jehoram and to Ahaziah in the south. The relations between the north and the south. But then we have the next king, Jehu. Who was Jehu and how was he chosen to be king? 2 Kings chapter 9, starting at verse 1. The prophet Elisha summoned a man from the company of the prophets and said to him, "Tuck your cloak into your belt. Take this flask of oil with you and go to Ramoth Gilead. When you get there, look for Jehu, son of Jehoshaphat, the son of Nimshi. Go to him, get him away from his companions, and take him into an inner room. Then take the flask and pour the oil on his head and declare, 'This is what the Lord says. I anoint you as king over Israel.' Then open the door and run. Don't delay." So the young man, the prophet, went to Ramoth Gilead. When he arrived, he found the army officers sitting together. "I have a message for you, commander," he said. "For which of us?" asked Jehu. "For you, commander," he replied. Jehu got up, went into the house, and the prophet poured oil on Jehu's head and declared, "This is what Yahweh, the God of Israel, says. I anoint you king over the Lord's people, Israel. You are to destroy the house of Ahab, your master." Remember how that had been foretold to Ahab, that his whole family would be wiped out, just like that of Jeroboam and that of Baasha? Okay. "You are to destroy the house of Ahab, your master, and I will avenge the blood of my servants, the prophets, and the blood of all the Lord's servants shed by Jezebel. The whole house of Ahab will perish. I will cut off from Ahab every last male in Israel, slave or free. I'll make the house of Ahab like the house of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, and like the house of Baasha, son of Ahijah. So they cease to exist." Okay? So Jehu was an army commander for Israel, who was then anointed by a prophet that Elisha sent to become the next king. So what was Jehu's first responsibility, and how successful was he? Well, his first responsibility, we just saw, was to destroy the house of Ahab. So how did that turn out? Well, let's look at that. Verse 24, if I had read a little bit too far earlier. "Then Jehu drew his bow and shot Joram between the shoulders. The arrow pierced his heart, and he slumped down in his chariot." Then verse 27, "When Ahaziah, king of Judah, saw what had happened, he fled up the road to Beth-Hagen. Jehu chased him, shouting, 'Kill him too!' They wounded him in his chariot on the way to Gur near Ibleam, but he escaped to Megiddo and died there." So Jehu then kills Joram, King Joram, the son of Ahab, king of the north, and Ahaziah, king of the south, who happened to be Ahab's grandson, right? Ahaziah was the son of Athaliah and Jehoram of the south, who Athaliah was a daughter of Ahab. Okay? I'm afraid I might be confusing you here, but the point is that here he's wiped out, he's killed the two kings, both of whom are descendants of Ahab. And that was his command by God, was to wipe out Ahab's family. Then, verse 30, "Jehu went to Jezreel. When Jezebel heard about it, she painted her eyes, arranged her hair, and looked out of a window." Okay, so Jezebel's there in Jezreel. Verse 33, "Throw her down," Jehu said. So they threw her down, and some of her blood splattered the wall and the horses as they trampled her underfoot. Okay, so here we have Jezebel killed. And it goes on and talks about the story there about how dogs ate her body, just as was foretold by Elisha, or by Elijah. Then chapter 10, verse 7, we see that he sent a letter to Samaria, to the officials of Jezreel, and to the elders and the guardians of Ahab's children. We see in verse 1 of chapter 10. And he sent, when the letters arrived, the men took all the princes, all the descendants of Ahab, and slaughtered all 70 of them. They put their heads in baskets and sent them to Jehu in Jezreel. Okay, so Jehu had all of Ahab's 70 sons beheaded. And then, one other point, in verse 12, Jehu then set out and went towards Samaria at Beth-Aked of the shepherds. He met some relatives of Ahaziah, king of Judah, and asked, "Who are you?" They said, "We're relatives of Ahaziah, and we've come down to greet the families of the king and of the queen mother." "Take him alive," he orders. They took him alive and slaughtered them by the well of Beth-Aked. 42 men. He left no survivor. So here he has 42 relatives of Ahaziah killed. So you see, he goes through and eliminates Ahab's family. Now, he is also to wipe out the prophets of Baal. How was he going to do that? What did he do? This is an interesting story. Chapter 10, starting in verse 18, "Jehu brought all the people together and said to them, 'Ahab served Baal a little bit. Jehu is going to serve much. Now, summon all the prophets of Baal, all his ministers and all his priests. See that no one is missing because I'm going to hold a great sacrifice for Baal. Anyone who fails to come will no longer live. But Jehu is acting deceptively in order to destroy the ministers of Baal. So he got all the Baal ministers, the prophets, the priests, all of those of Baal, all together, brought them into this into this temple here. And then verse 25, as soon as Jehu had finished making the burnt offering, he ordered the guards and officers, go in and kill them, let no one escape. So they cut him down with the sword. The guards and officers threw the bodies out and entered the inner shrine of the temple of Baal. They brought out the sacred stone out of the temple of Baal and burned it. They demolished the sacred stone of Baal and tore down the temple of Baal, and the people have used it for a latrine to this day. Okay? So you see, he not only got rid of Ahab's family, but he also got rid of all the Baal worship. He got rid of the Baal prophets, the Baal priests, and destroyed and desecrated the Baal temple. Okay? And so here we see definitely a positive direction here with Jehu going, maybe a good king here after all, because he's standing up for Yahweh, right? And getting rid of all the Baal stuff. Well, how did God bless Jehu in response to the purge of Ahab and Baal? Verse 30. The Lord said to Jehu, because you have done well in accomplishing what is right in my eyes and have done to the house of Ahab all that I had in mind to do, your descendants will sit on the throne of Israel to the fourth generation. So he blessed Jehu by giving him four generations of descendants on the throne of Israel. Okay? So it's quite a promise. It's like the promise that he gave to David that he would always have a descendant on the throne because of his faith in God. So it sounds like Jehu was a man after God's heart. Here we have a Yahweh king, right? But if you look at page 10, it says bad mostly. Why? Why was Jehu still considered evil in the eyes of the Lord? Verse 29. Well, sorry, 28. So Jehu destroyed Baal worship in Israel. However, he did not turn away from the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, which he had caused Israel to commit, the worship of the golden calves at Bethel and Dan. So he continued the Jeroboam religion. So he's just as bad as Jeroboam, of Baasha, of all the other kings before him. Okay, he got rid of the Baal, but he still left the Jeroboam worship there. There was also a big significant loss during Jehu's reign. We see verse 32. In those days, the Lord began to reduce the size of Israel. Hazael, okay, remember Hazael was the king of Aram. We read about him. Overpowered the Israelites throughout their territory east of the Jordan in all the land of Gilead, the region of Gad, Reuben, and Manasseh, from Aroer by the Arnon Gorge through Gilead to Bashan. Okay, so they lost the land east of the Jordan River, the first land that the Israelites picked up when they came out of the desert. Now they've lost it to Syria. So Israel only goes up as far as the Jordan River at this time because of that loss. All right, well, that's Jehu. Now, who's next? Jehoahaz. Who was Jehoahaz and how faithful was his reign? Chapter 13, verses 1 and 2. In the 23rd year of Joash, son of Ahaziah, king of Judah, Jehoahaz, the son of Jehu, became king of Israel and Samaria, and he reigned for 17 years. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord by following the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, which he had caused Israel to commit, and he did not turn away from them. Verse 6, they did not turn away from the sins of the house of Jeroboam. They continued in them. Also, the Asherah pole remained standing in Samaria. So he was even a little worse than his dad, Jehu. Okay, so Jehoahaz was Jehu's son, evil in God's eyes. Besides Jeroboam's religion, he kept that Asherah pole standing in Samaria, the state capital, the national capital of Samaria. How did God respond to Jehoahaz's unfaithfulness? Verse 3, so the Lord's anger burned against Israel, and for a long time he kept them under the power of Hazael, king of Aram, and Ben-Hadad, his son. And then verse 7, nothing had been left of the army of Jehoahaz except 50 horsemen, 10 chariots, and 10,000 foot soldiers, for the king of Aram had destroyed the rest and made them like dust at threshing time. Jehoahaz was under the power, under the control of Aram, of Syria, during his time. Most of his army was destroyed. He didn't have a chance to even try to fight. Okay? That was Jehoahaz. He lasted 17 years, then he was followed by Jehoash. Who was that? Verse 10, in the 37th year of Joash, king of Judah, Jehoash, son of Jehoahaz, became king of Israel and Samaria, and he reigned 16 years. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord, did not turn away from any of the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, which he had caused Israel to commit. He continued in them. Okay, so Jehoash was Jehoahaz's son, therefore Jehu's grandson. So this is the next generation, just as God had promised. But he likewise was evil in the eyes of the Lord. Now, Elisha was still around at this time. Okay, if you remember back when we talked about Elisha, that Elisha was a prophet to Joram, Jehu, Jehoahaz, and Jehoash. So it was during Jehoash's time then that Elijah died. How was Jehoash helped by Elisha? Chapter 13, verse 15, we read this before. This is where Elisha says, get a bow and some arrows, take the bow in your hands and shoot it out. And that's the Lord's arrow of victory, the arrow of victory over Aram. You will completely destroy the Arameans at Aphek. Then take the arrow, strike the ground. He did three times. He says you should have struck the ground five or six times. Then you would have defeated Aram and completely destroyed it. But now you'll defeat it only three times. So with this, Jehoash receives some victories. Okay, God comes and helps Joash. And where his dad, Jehoahaz, was under the heavy thumb of Syria, of Aram, all his reign, Jehoash gets out of that to a degree. Okay? Now, we also see in chapter 14 that Amaziah, the king of Judah, challenges Jehoash to fight. And how does Jehoash respond? Verse 10, you have indeed defeated Edom, and now you're arrogant. Glory in your victory, but stay home. Why ask for trouble and cause your own downfall and that of Judah also? Amaziah, however, would not listen, so Jehoash, king of Israel, attacked. He and Amaziah, king of Judah, faced each other at Beth Shemesh in Judah. Judah was routed by Israel, and every man fled to his home. Jehoash, king of Israel, captured Amaziah, king of Judah, the son of Joash, son of Ahaziah, at Beth Shemesh. Then Jehoash went to Jerusalem and broke down the wall of Jerusalem from the Ephraim gate to the corner gate, a section about 600 feet long. He took all the gold and silver and all the articles found in the temple of the Lord and the treasuries of the royal palace. He also took hostages and returned to Samaria. So here we see when he was taunted, Amaziah, the king of Judah, had had a victory over Edom and thought, hey, I got a lot of power now. Okay, he defeated 10,000 Edomites, we see in verse 7, in the Valley of Salt and captured Selah in battle. And then he picks a fight with Israel and Jehoash says, don't do it. Okay? He tried to avoid it. But when Amaziah pushed, he went to battle. And he fought, he won, and he didn't just stop with the victory. He looted Jerusalem. He looted the temple. He took all the valuables out of the temple and took those back to Samaria with him. So that's Jehoash. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord, worshiping the gods of Jeroboam. Then we have another Jeroboam. Okay, this is not the same. Who was this Jeroboam and how faithful was his reign? Chapter 14, verse 23. In the 15th year of Amaziah, son of Joash, king of Judah, Jeroboam, the son of Jehoash, king of Israel, became king in Samaria, and he reigned for 41 years. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord, did not turn away from any of the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, which he caused Israel to commit. So this is a different Jeroboam. He has no relation whatsoever to the first Jeroboam. Remember, that first Jeroboam's family was entirely wiped out. So this is Jehoash's son. He named him Jeroboam. So that shows you how much Jehoash liked Jeroboam's religions here, right? And he became king. He was king quite a while, 41 years it says, but he was evil in the eyes of the Lord because he continued in the sins of Jeroboam the first. He also fulfilled a prophecy by Jonah, which is interesting. 2 Kings chapter 14, verse 25 says, he was the one who restored the boundaries of Israel from Lebo Hamath to the Sea of the Arabah in accordance with the word of the Lord, the God of Israel, spoken through his servant Jonah, the son of Amittai, the prophet from Gath-Hepher. Okay? So he then restored Israel's boundaries from Lebo Hamath to the Dead Sea. He gained control over Aram. So the Arameans, who had been so much trouble to his grandfather and a bit to his father, Jeroboam the second was able to take care of to a degree. So things got to looking up a little bit during Jeroboam the second's reign. And you see in our picture that this is the time of wealth and prosperity. So even though there was trouble with Syria, there was still a lot of wealth. And gosh, Jehoash got a lot of wealth when he went and raided all the temple down in Judah, right? And he picked up all this land, and so things were well. But there was trouble. Just because there's wealth and prosperity doesn't mean that things are good with God. In fact, there's trouble with that. We deal with that. We live in a time of wealth and prosperity. And are we in the most faithful time of, with God? No, we've struggled with unfaithfulness all around us all the time. And so it was during this time of Jeroboam that God sent a couple more prophets. You see Hosea and Amos there. Okay, and the purposes of Hosea and Amos, if you look at their books, these prophets came to warn the Israelites against spiritual lackness during this golden age. When things are good, we don't often turn to God, and the Israelites definitely didn't. And so the prophets came with the role of the prophet to call the people back to God, to remind them of their destiny, and especially with the threat of wealth and prosperity. Okay, during this golden age. Well, we then see that things start to go downhill because now we're done with the gold and we're starting to get into the orange and the red. Our next one we see is Zechariah. Okay, Zechariah, we see there he's only 6 months. Who was Zechariah? How faithful was his reign? Verse 8 of chapter 15. In the 38th year of Azariah, king of Judah, Zechariah, son of Jeroboam, became king of Israel in Samaria, and he reigned 6 months. So this is Jeroboam's son. So what do we see? From Jehu to Jehoahaz to Jehoash to Jeroboam to Zechariah, right? That's fulfilling the promise that that God had made to Jehu of having four descendants on the throne, which we see confirmed in verse 12. It says, "So the word of the Lord spoken to Jehu was fulfilled. Your descendants will sit on the throne of Israel to the fourth generation." Now, Zechariah was only there for 6 months. Okay, we saw there in verse 8. But he was there. So he counted as the fourth generation. Now, how faithful was he? Verse 9, he did evil in the eyes of the Lord as his fathers had done. He did not turn away from the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, which he had caused Israel to commit. So there's Zechariah. We won't say any more about him. He's only 6 months. What about the next guy? Next one we see is Shallum. Okay, you see that on the picture there. And who was Shallum? How did he become king? Well, his story is actually in the middle of Zechariah's story. Shallum, this, verse 10, son of Jabesh, conspired against Zechariah. He attacked him in front of the people, assassinated him, and succeeded him as king. Okay, so Shallum became king by assassinating, by killing Zechariah. That's why Zechariah was only king for 6 months. And he did so in public. Okay, he attacked him in front of the people. He did so in public. Well, he was only king for 1 month, we see there, right? And we see that in verse 13. He became king, he reigned in Samaria for 1 month. And then what happened? Then Menahem, son of Gadi, went from Tirzah up to Samaria. He attacked Shallum, son of Jabesh in Samaria, assassinated him, and succeeded him as king. You see in a pattern here? Okay, it's now things are really getting out of control. We've got this period of rapid decline that's starting here. You've had Shallum go and assassinated Zechariah so that he became king. Then Menahem assassinated Shallum, and he became king. Verse, we see he was a son of Gadi, whoever that is, from Tirzah. Now we see that during his time, we have some problems. Okay, we have the erupting volcano on his thing there. It's not just a volcano like we had at Omri. But here we have an erupting volcano that says that Assyria now becomes a violent threat. No longer are we dealing with just Syria or Aram, but now we have Assyria, which is a major, major, major power that is very bloodthirsty and not nice to their enemies. And so they become a violent threat. That's why we have it erupting there to Israel's freedom. So they then are forced to pay tribute to Assyria, which is what we see there by those coins at the base. Okay? And let's look at that, verses 19. Then Pul, king of Assyria, invaded the land, and Menahem gave him 1,000 talents of silver. Okay, 1,000 talents is about 37 tons of silver to gain his support and strengthen his own hold on the kingdom. Okay, so Menahem, who got into power by assassinating his predecessor, then gets the support of Assyria by giving him all this money. Menahem exacted this money from Israel. Every wealthy man had to contribute 50 shekels of silver, okay, which is about one and a quarter pounds of silver, to be given to the king of Assyria. So the king of Assyria withdrew and stayed in the land no longer. So there we see the tribute to Assyria taken from the people, and, you know, it's protection money. But Menahem is also using that to secure his own position there. We see then that he, in verse 17, he reigned in Samaria for 10 years. And then what happened? Verse 23, in the 15th year of, Menahem rested, verse 22, rested with his father. So he just died. And Pekahiah, his son, succeeded him as king. Pekahiah, son of Menahem, became king of Israel and Samaria. He reigned for 2 years. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord, did not turn away from the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, which he had caused Israel to commit. Okay? So Menahem's son Pekahiah took over and continued in the sins, but he only ruled for 2 years. Why? Next verse. One of his chief officers, Pekah, son of Remaliah, conspired against him. Taking 50 men of Gilead with him, he assassinated Pekahiah, along with Argob and Eri, in the citadel of the royal palace at Samaria. So Pekah killed Pekahiah and succeeded him as king. So here we have another assassination. Another person decides he wants to be king, and so he becomes king by killing the existing king. Okay? So Pekah then becomes king. Now, he didn't have the relationship with Pul, Tiglath-Pileser, the king of Assyria, that Menahem did with before. So he loses some territory, we see in verse 29. In the time of Pekah, king of Israel, Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came and took Ijon, Abel-Beth-Maacah, Genoa, Kadesh, and Hazor. He took Gilead and Galilee, including all the land of Naphtali, and deported the people to Assyria. So he lost a lot of territory. You've got Gilead, okay, the stuff on the east side of the Jordan River. You got Galilee, up all the stuff up at the north side. Naphtali, that whole area. All this area was taken by the Assyrians, and the people that lived there were deported. So those people ceased to exist as Israelites. They were deported and scattered in Assyria, which is what the Assyrians would do. They didn't take them like we'll see in next week's lesson when we talk about the southern kingdom. That we'll see that the Babylonians, who then conquer Judah, they took the people of Judah and kept them together as one people. The Assyrians didn't do that. They would take their conquests and scatter them throughout their empire so that they couldn't be a group that would stay powerful and strong and be a threat. Okay? So, we see here on Pekah, we see this manuscript peg here on the left. And that reminds us that Pekah allied himself with Syria against Judah and Assyria. He's trying to figure out a way with Assyria coming down and he's got enemies on the south side with Judah. What does he do to protect himself? What does he do to get his land back? Let's look at some of the verses. Verse 37 says, in those days, the Lord began to send Rezin, king of Aram, and Pekah, son of Remaliah, against Judah. Okay, so he teamed up with the king of Aram to fight against Judah. And then, verse 5 to 9, Rezin, king of Aram, and Pekah, son of Remaliah, king of Israel, marched up to fight against Jerusalem and besieged Ahaz, but they could not overpower him. At that time, Rezin, king of Aram, recovered Elath for Aram by driving out the men of Judah. Edomites then moved into Elath and have lived there to this day. Ahaz, okay, the king of Judah, sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria. I'm your servant and vassal. Come up and save me out of the hands of the king of Aram and the king of Israel who are attacking me. And Ahaz took the silver and gold found in the temple of the Lord and in the treasuries of the royal palace and sent it as a gift to the king of Assyria. The king of Assyria complied by attacking Damascus and capturing it. He deported its inhabitants to Kir and put Rezin to death. All right. So you see that Pekah kind of forgot a little bit about Assyria and focused on Judah and decided to attack Judah along with an ally that he formed with the Syrians, with the Arameans. And they went and attacked, and the king of Judah went to the king of Assyria and said, hey, come help me here. And he did, and Assyria came to Judah's rescue. Lots of other stories there, but one other note. We see the banner of Isaiah there. And so this is the time that Isaiah pops up. Now, Isaiah really focused more so on bringing God's word to the southern kingdom. Isaiah was there as the northern kingdom of Israel was going under, okay, was going away. And Isaiah focused a lot on the southern kingdom by saying, look at what Israel, what's happening to Israel. The same can happen to you if you don't repent and return to God and all of that, okay? But we see the timing here, Isaiah chapter 7. When Ahaz, son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, was king of Judah, King Rezin of Aram and Pekah, son of Remaliah, king of Israel, marched up to fight against Jerusalem, but they could not overpower it. That's the story we just read. Now the house of David was told, Aram has allied itself with Ephraim, so the hearts of Ahaz and his people were shaken as the trees of the forest were shaken by the wind. Then the Lord said to Isaiah, go out, you and your son, Shear-Jashub, to meet Ahaz at the end of the aqueduct of the upper pool on the road to the waterman's field. Say to him, be careful, keep calm, and don't be afraid. Do not lose heart because of these two smoldering stubs of firewood, because of the fierce anger of Rezin and Aram and the son of Remaliah. Aram, Ephraim, and Remaliah's son have plotted your ruin, saying, let us invade Judah. Let us tear it apart and divide it among ourselves and make the son of Tabeel king over it. Well, this is what the sovereign Yahweh says. It will not take place. It will not happen. For the head of Aram is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is only Rezin. Within 65 years, Ephraim will be too shattered to be a people. The head of Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is only Remaliah's son. If you do not stand firm in your faith, you will not stand at all. Okay? So, Isaiah came to prophesy to Judah during this attack by Pekah, and he foretold the destruction of Israel that was about to happen. And that's what we see then next. Okay, now we see that Pekah was there for 20 years, so a good while, but then we have Hosea. Hosea was the last one. He was there for 9 years. Who was he? How did he become king? Well, you can probably guess. He wasn't Pekah's son. Instead, chapter 15, verse 30, Hosea, son of Elah, conspired against Pekah, son of Remaliah. He attacked and assassinated him and then succeeded him as king in the 20th year of Jotham, son of Uzziah. So here we have another assassination. It's, if you want to become king in Israel, that's, I guess, how you had to do it at this time. You see, there's a manuscript pegged there with Hosea. He had this problem with Assyria, just like Pekah did. Okay? What's he going to do? Well, allying with Aram, which is with Syria, which is what Pekah did, isn't going to work. Okay, that failed. So who else is he ally with? We'll look at chapter 17, verses 3 to 4. Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up to attack Hosea, who had been Shalmaneser's vassal and had paid him tribute. But the king of Assyria discovered that Hosea was a traitor, for he had sent envoys to So, king of Egypt, and he no longer paid tribute to the king of Assyria as he had done year by year. Therefore, Shalmaneser seized him, put him in prison. The king of Assyria, okay, so Hosea decided he didn't want to keep paying the tribute to Assyria, so he stopped doing so and he allied himself with the Egyptians. And that's what the manuscript peg reminds us of. It's a military alliance with Egypt to help him stand against Assyria. But that didn't work. He got arrested. He got captured, okay, was taken by Shalmaneser and put in prison. And then what happened? Verse 5, we already read verse 4. Verse 5, the king of Assyria invaded the land, marched against Samaria, and laid siege to it for 3 years. The king of Assyria imprisoned Hoshea, the king, and then lay, without any leaders there, he besieged Israel for 3 years. Then verse 6, in the 9th year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria captured Samaria and deported the Israelites to Assyria. He settled them in Hala, in Gozan, on the Habor River, and in the towns of the Medes. Okay? So the Assyrians came in, and he didn't just say, okay, you're now my captives. The Assyrians were very bloodthirsty, very violent people, and violently overtook Israel. And in doing so, whatever they didn't kill off, they then took with them. And again, they didn't settle them in one place in Assyria, but they scattered them throughout Assyria so that these people, the northern nation of Israel, no longer existed as a people. They were now dispersed and they intermixed and they ceased to exist. So you've heard of the lost tribes of Israel? Well, that's how they were lost. That's what happened to them. And then so what did he also do then? Verse 24, the king of Assyria brought people from Babylon, Cutha, Ava, Hamath, and Sepharvaim, okay, so other lands that the Assyrians had conquered, and settled them in towns of Assyria to replace the Israelites. They took over Samaria and lived in its towns. So now, he didn't just leave the northern nation of Israel, northern nation of Samaria, fallow and empty so that anyone could just go in there, but it's part of his territory now, right? And so he settles it with other people that he had conquered. So the people then that lived there were not Israelite at all. Okay? Not Israelite at all. So we have this dark red color down here at Hoshea, and that reminds us that a full-scale destruction came to the north during Hoshea's reign. And then the other thing, just the overall crumbling look of the kingdom reminds us that the whole kingdom was destroyed. Assyria destroyed the northern kingdom in 722 B.C. So let's recap the picture here real quick. We've got three colors here. The first color, the dark section of crumbling earth, is the age of civil strife. So these first 100 years of kings was met with a lot of civil strife with the southern nation of Judah. Then in the middle, we have about 100 years of the golden age, okay? This golden section, the age of wealth and prosperity. And then at the bottom, the orange and red section of crumbling earth is the age of rapid decline. Now looking at some of the symbols, at the very first one we see with Jeroboam, the golden calf, and that reminds us that Jeroboam had established his own religion and religious shrines at Dan and Bethel. Going further at Omri, we see the volcano and the coins of tribute there. Israel was threatened by Syria, by Aram, in the reigns really from Baasha to Omri. The snake then on Ahab, Omri's son Ahab, ushered in Baalism into Israel, especially through his wife Jezebel. It was during that time then that God sent Elijah, major prophet. The black there reminds us of the judgment, the doom that he brought, that he warned about. Also following him then came Elisha for some of the kings that followed Ahab there. The white there reminds us of the hope that prophets brought. Going further on Jeroboam II, we see a couple more prophets, Hosea and Amos. And these prophets, you see, this is during the time of the Golden Age, and they came to warn against spiritual laxness during a time of wealth and prosperity. Next, we have the erupting volcano on Menahem, and that reminds us that during Menahem, Assyria became a violent threat to the freedom of Israel. The two coins at the base of the volcano remind us that Israel was forced to pay tribute to Assyria. Going further, we've got the manuscript peg on Pekah, and that reminds us that Pekah allied himself with Aram, with Syria, to go against Judah and Assyria, and that all backfired on him. It was also during his time that Isaiah came, and Isaiah prophesied destruction of the northern kingdom during Pekah. The manuscript peg on Hosea reminds us that Hosea attempted a military alliance with Egypt against Assyria, and that backfired on him. The dark red color of Hosea reminds us that the full-scale destruction of the northern nation of Israel came during Hosea's reign. The overall portraying of the crumbling kingdom reminds us that Assyria destroyed the northern kingdom in 722 BC. Why? Why did all of this happen? Well, 2 Kings chapter 17, and this is a little lengthy, but it's key because it tells us the whole story. It's kind of the summary, the Reader's Digest of what we've been reading and why God allowed his northern nation of Israel to be totally destroyed. It says in verse 7 that all of this took place because the Israelites had sinned against the Lord their God, who had brought them up out of Egypt from under the power of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. They worshipped other gods and followed the practices of the nations that the Lord had driven out before them, as well as the practices that the kings of Israel had introduced. The Israelites secretly did things against the Lord their God that were not right. From watchtower to fortified city, they built themselves high places in all their towns. They set up sacred stones and Asherah poles on every high hill and under every spreading tree. At every high place, they burned incense, as the nations whom the Lord had driven out before them had done. They did wicked things that provoked the Lord to anger. They worshipped idols, though the Lord had said, "You shall not do this." The Lord warned Israel and Judah through all of his prophets and seers, "Turn from your evil ways. Observe my commands and decrees in accordance with the entire law that I commanded your fathers to obey, and that I delivered to you through my servants, the prophets." But they wouldn't listen, and they were as stiff-necked as their fathers, who didn't trust in the Lord their God. They rejected his decrees and the covenant that he had made with their fathers and the warnings that he had given them. They followed worthless idols and themselves became worthless. They imitated the nations around them, although the Lord had ordered them, "Don't do as they do." And they did the things that the Lord had forbidden them to do. They forsook all of the commands of the Lord their God. They made for themselves two idols cast in the shape of calves and an Asherah pole. They bowed down to all the starry hosts and they worshiped Baal. They even sacrificed their sons and daughters in the fire. They practiced divination and sorcery and sold themselves to do evil in the eyes of the Lord, provoking him to anger. So the Lord was very angry with Israel and he removed them from his presence. Only the tribe of Judah was left, and even Judah did not keep the commands of the Lord their God. They followed the practices that Israel had introduced. Therefore, the Lord rejected all the people of Israel. He afflicted them and gave them into the hands of plunderers until he thrust them from his presence. When he tore Israel away from the house of David, they made Jeroboam, son of Nebat, their king. Jeroboam enticed Israel away from following the Lord and caused them to commit a great sin. The Israelites persisted in all the sins of Jeroboam and did not turn away from them until the Lord removed them from his presence, just as he had warned through all of his servants and prophets. So the people of Israel were taken from their homeland into exile in Assyria, and they're still there. That's the story of the northern nation of Israel. And we see in the middle of that there in verse 19 that even Judah followed some of those practices. And we'll see some of that next week, okay, when we talk about the southern kingdom. Let's close in prayer. God, our Father, oh, what stories you have for us. But they're stories, through those stories, through the continued rejection that the northern nation of Israel had for you, you stayed there with them. Even though from the very beginning, Jeroboam turned himself, turned his nation, turned his people away from you and towards these man-made gods, and you knew that they would persist in that, you were still very patient with them. Rather than wiping them out within the first few years that they so greatly deserved, you worked on them. You sent your prophets to them over hundreds of years trying to call them back to you. We thank you for those stories because it reminds us of your great patience with us. That as we continue to turn from you and fail to obey you as you require, you're patient with us. You call us back to us. You want us to return. You don't pleasure in our destruction, but rather you pleasure in us coming back to you. Please continue to send your Spirit into our lives to call us back to you and to show us the error of our ways, just as the prophets showed the error of the ways to the Israelites that had rejected you. Thank you for the forgiveness that you offer through your Son, Jesus Christ, that does pave that way for us to come back to you. We pray in His name. Amen.